Well, thanks a lot for the invitation to come here and also to, of course, the honor of receiving this medal and giving a medallion lecture. So where do I put this? So what I will try to do in this talk is to give a sort of an overview. I mean, with Bike and Date, some 5-6 years ago now, we connected random matrix distributions with other problems of a more combinatorial nature, like the longest increasing subsequence, I should say, in a random permutation. And this has led to sort of the occurrence of the random matrix distributions in contexts where you don't really expect them. So non-intersecting paths is a sort of pattern which you can see behind many of these problems. I will not present things in any kind of historical way. Rather, it's how I sort of look upon this today, or one way of thinking about it. So I will sort of go through rather many. I will not present theorems in any detail. Rather, I will go through some general structures and some examples of this general structure and give you the interpretations of these particular cases, and you will see how the similarities between them. And then I will talk about sort of the mathematical structure which underlies it, and which is what makes it possible to prove things and compute limit distributions. So I start out a little technically here with, I mean, we have to talk then about non-intersecting paths. So what's used here is something called the Lindström-Gesser-Villeneuve theorem. So let me present that first. So what you have here, you have some directed graph like this, which, and you have some points which are called initial points, U1, U2, U3 here, and you have some final point V1 up to V3, and then you have a directed acyclic graph. And we have we want to look at sort of non-intersecting paths then, which connects U1 with V1, U2 with V2, and so on. And you have a condition here which sort of, I mean, that the path should not be able to cross unless they do it at a vertex like this. So there is a condition. So there is these points are ordered U1, U2, U3, V1, V2, V3. And if the higher index goes with the lower and the other way around, they have to meet at the point. So there is really a crossing at the vertex. So these are sort of conditions for this result. So if you have a planar graph like this, you can see what it means. So to each edge in this graph, we assign a certain weight. And you can then think about the transition weight, kind of non-normalized transition probability of going from a point ui to a point vj there. What you do then is that you take the product of all the weights in a path connecting these two points, then, and then you sum over all possible paths. So this gives you sort of some kind of weight for going from ui to vj. So think of this as like a transition probability in Brownian motion or something like that, random walk. So this is sort of a general setup. Then this theorem, which is behind many of the results, then says the following thing, then, that if I look at the weight of all non-intersecting paths connecting U1 to V1, U2 to V2, and so on, so what this means by definition then is that you have paths pi1, pi n, which connect the points, as I said, then you take the product of the edges along each of these paths and the product over all these n paths, and then you sum over all possible weights of connecting them. So this is like a total weight of non-intersecting paths then connecting these points in the right order. And the theorem is this equality here, which tells you that this expression here is actually a determinant here. So it's a determinant involving this transition weight that I just defined here. So the way you see this is that, I mean, if you expand this, you will get lots of products of things like that. And everything except those corresponding to this thing that come here will cancel out due to the conditions that I just described here. So it's not really so difficult to prove this, but this means that when you're looking at non-intersecting parts like this, what you're actually looking at are determinants of this form here. Okay, so this is a rather general theorem. So the general structures in the examples I will discuss this look something like this. So let me tell you how you can get some kind of measure, probability measure from this now. So this is sort of a schematic picture. So imagine that in between here you have some kind of directed graph here which goes sort of to the right here. And in the same way, you have some directed graph here, which connects the other side here. And you think of these points, U1, U2 up to UN, and V1 up to VN, as some fixed points. These are fixed from the beginning. And then I look at all these non-intersecting paths going through these graphs here, and I define some intermediate points here. You can think of some, I take some line in the middle there. And then, of course, I mean, these paths could go to different configurations of points here. So I can get a probability measure on the configuration C1 up to Cn then by having this fixed and normalizing all over all the probabilities, these weights that I have. That, okay? So there is a certain weight given by a determinant of going from this point to these points. And then there's another weight going the other. So there would actually be a product of one determinant here and one determinant for the second one. I could introduce several lines here and look at the points there also. And I would have a product of several determinants then, which would give me the weight of the configuration, right? And then I would have to normalize over all possibilities to get a probability measure. So in this way, I can construct probability measures from non-intersecting paths. So each sort of transition step here is given by a determinant. That's from this Winston-Gesell-Viennot theorem. So, of course, if I have several, I could sort of integrate out by summing over all the possibilities in between. And, of course, this should be consistent, then, right? I mean, I should get a determinant again. So there is a kind of marker property here, which if I take a product like this over these one determinant there, and the other determinant going, giving the second step, and I sum over all the ordered configurations in between here. Then, of course, it has to be the case from the Lindstrom-Gesell-Viennot theorem that this equals the transition of going from combining these two things and going from U1 to V1 and so on. Okay. So there is a natural sort of Markovian type of property like this. This is actually sort of from the point of view of, this is of course just some kind of determinantal identity, right? So to be a little technical here at the beginning, I mean this is something which I usually call the Heine identity, there are the other names also, which says that, which sort of lies behind a lot of the mathematical structure in this problem, is that if I have a determinant like this, so this is one of these transitions, right? And then another one, and I integrate. So you see this is built from, I have some function, and I integrate out the xj's that I have there. Then this integrating out gives me, again, a determinant here. And this n factorial is what this ordering I had in the beginning, in this example here. So there is a natural way of sort of building things by having products of determinants like this and looking at the intermediate configurations of the points. So this was a very general thing now. So let me come to some examples now which involve this thing, and it will be a little clearer. Perhaps before I go this, there is a continuous version here which is actually older, which is the Colin McGregor theorem from the late 50s, which sort of is the same thing if I have Markov processes instead here. So if I start at some points on the line here, ordered points, and I have, say, one-dimensional Brownian motion, evolving on that line. So this is the time direction now. And I condition them not to intersect during this time interval. Then Colin and McGregor showed that the probability density then now, in this case, of having this transition from this configuration to that configuration without collisions is given by a determinant like this, where this is the transition density then for the Brownian motion. So the, if there's some other continuous, some other diffusion. So in this case, so this, in the general case, I had some transition weight here. But in this case, when you have Brownian motions, what you have in these determinants would be just the transition probability for Brownian motion. Okay, so there's a natural continuous version of that. So let me come now to some examples. And I will give you four examples here, basically. And they will be connected to some of the, actually most of the exactly solvable models in this setting, now, where you can really get some kind of explicit limiting results. Yes, right. Well, you can, I mean, if you think about it, you can think of it, if you think about a random walk, I mean, you have weights on uniform weights, I mean, on the edges. So you could sort of think of it. This is actually a kind of continuum limit of a random walk situation, which would fit in the other picture. So let me give you now, go through sort of four different examples of this construction, and then I will come to the interpretation of these examples. So I will present you with the examples first, and then I will tell you why they are interesting, which is not obvious, I mean, when I just tell you about them. So they may look rather arbitrary to begin with. So I mean, I could build this non-intersect, this directed graph, I can build it by taking some simple building blocks. So I have some simple transition steps. I have what I call an up step. So I go from one sort of line to another line. So you can imagine a particle could go from that point and then it could jump up to that point there. Right? We could just stay, go one step like this. And I put some weights, so weight one here and weight A on the vertical bond. Okay? And then there's a similar down step. So I could have the particle going to the right and then some number of steps down that. And I could, can put these together, right? I could take two M steps up, down, up, down, up, down. So. And I just putting these, I put this thing together with that thing, and you see I build a directed graph where I have these natural vertical lines where I could look at the configuration of each of these lines. So a configuration of non-intersecting paths could look something like this. Right? So I take some fixed initial and final positions, as I said. So here I take at level 0, minus 1, minus 2, and so on here. And I end up at the same point here. And then you see I could, so in this case you can think about having a particle then which moved along this. I have some kind of particle configuration on each vertical line here. So if I wanted to look what's the sort of induced probability distribution here, let's say, then I would have a transition determinant one step here and then another transition determinant to the end. Or I could look at the whole configuration, right? Then it would have a product of one determinant for each of these simple steps, which would induce some kind of measure on the particle configuration that I see here in the middle here. So only the initial and final configurations are fixed, whereas these in the middle could vary. Then. So using this Lindstrom Gesta Viennotium, I get in specifying some weights like this, I get an induced probability on these particle configurations here. Right? So this is what I mean by building a probability measure from non-intersecting paths. I could do the same construction differently. I mean, I could take first a number of up steps and then a number of down steps. I haven't drawn the picture. So first I go just up and then I go just down. I mean, you can imagine varying this construction with these sort of basic steps like this. Here's another variation. I replace the up step by just by this directed graph instead, where I can go either one step to the right or one step up. So that's a different one that I had before. And then I alternate these instead. And again, I have the same initial and final configuration. So then I have some other picture of non-intersecting paths like this. Perhaps the simplest one you could think of is one we started is just random, simple random walks. Right? I mean, you could have a picture like this, where I started some every other point. So this, if this is the integer, integers at each line here, I start at 0, 2, say, and so on. And then you have one particle which goes like this and one which goes like that, and they do not intersect these random walk paths. So this you perhaps would be in some way the easiest example you could think of somehow. Yeah. Although it turns out that this is more complicated analytically than the ones I just talked about. I will say a little about that later if I have time. So, but in this case, I mean, it's rather clear the familiar random walk paths that you're looking at here. So a kind of continuous version of this, one way of looking at it, is to take non-intersecting Brownian motions. And I could actually have them to start at just a single point here. And they split immediately into different paths and they come together at some point again here. Or you could imagine them starting at some different points also. But this particular case is interesting in many ways. So in this case, the transition is just the Brownian motion transition function. So I could then look at what's the induced sort of configuration at different times here. At one time or jointly at several times. This will give me natural particle configuration. So why are these examples interesting then? Yes? Yeah, right. I mean, one way of constructing this as a continuous limit would be to take some point at some distance and then let that go to zero eventually. Yeah. That's one way of doing it. So that's right. I mean, so let me now come back to these examples and give you some interpretation of them. So the first one is very naturally related to a certain growth model known as the polynuclear growth model. It's a discrete polynuclear growth model. So actually you can get the paths now, the non-intersecting paths, via a sort of growth mechanism. So let me briefly describe this. So you have some randomness coming down. So you start with a unit block like this of a certain height, where the height is a geometric random variable. So now it happened to be 1. Right? So I have this height 1. So I start at sort of a 0 height level everywhere. So I have this basic level. That this vertical sides here, the up steps move a unit step to the left at each time step. And the down steps here, they move to the right with unit speed also. So everything will spread like this. Okay. So after one time step, this thing has length 3 now, and it's spread in this direction. And then at every other site now, so not here now, but at these points, I add some new randomness, again geometrically distributed. So I add a height 2 there and a height 1 there, okay, say. And then it grows again. So this will move to the left, and these two will collide then, say. So they collide over this red part here. So if they collide, I just sort of, the highest thing wins, okay, at the top level. And then again, I add some randomness, 1, 0, 3, 2, right? at every other lattice site here. And I keep track of the collisions also. So when the collisions, they sort of drop down and start an exactly the same growth procedure at the next level. So this is the zero level. This is the level minus one here. So you can see as this goes on, what you will get is some kind of picture like this, right? Where this is the top level. The growth of the top level is the polynuclear growth process. That's what you really, this is some kind of random height process, right? These things sort of just keep track of the collisions. Okay, so it's on the first, sorry, on, yeah, right. You add on the sort of the base, there's a basic layer which is growing, the first one, and you add on top of that. So you will have, the initial thing here will grow, and this will form a sort of a basic layer where the rest of the growth is. So you could also imagine dropping it throughout the line, but that would be a different case, more complicated actually. So I mean, you will, after a long time, you will have something which looks something like this, like a kind of random droplet. So you can write down this growth in a formula. So if h at position x at time t is the height of the top curve here, at point x, at time t, then there is, you can write a simple formula for this growth here. Now. So this. Well, you add at every. So you if you have sites like this, then the first one is added there, right? And then it grows, and then you can add. Then you can add at minus 1 and 1. So you add at every other site like this. Yeah, well, no, you could add in the middle also. Yeah. So you could add at some point, at some time it will have grown here, then I can add here, could add here, here, and here. So it's not just at the edges. I mean. Yeah, odd numbered or even number depending on the parity of time. So, yeah, maybe this was a little misleading. I could have had something there. Sorry about that. The layer down below, what you see here, you have a collision. So this one will go here, and this one will go here. And they collide over this point, this region here. And this collision here is the seed to the similar growth model on the next level. So the next level is decided what happens, the collisions that happens at the higher level. Well, you see, when you have a collision, this will collide over a region of size 1 here, right? Or it could be some other size where they collided also. This is sort of a randomness starting a same growth, just as I started here now. This thing drops down and gives, and that in the next step this will grow then, right? And maybe there are new collisions above here and they will drop down. And they will start a growth with exactly the same mechanism as at the next sort of growth layer there. Yeah. No, there's no new randomness coming. All the randomness comes in on the top part. Right? So if you write down what happens on the top part, the growth rule is like this. So this is some kind of smoothing mechanism, right? I mean, you have this randomness coming down, which adds some roughness. And then because of the spreading, there is some smoothing of the process. So there's sort of a competition here between the smoothing and the adding of the randomness. So you get some kind of rough profile here. and these are geometric random variables. And the point of keeping track of all the paths is actually you can run this backwards just by reversing time, and then you will get out all these numbers uniquely again. Because if I didn't keep track of the collisions, I wouldn't know how things have collided. I would sort of lose information. So this will make it, the mapping from the data that comes in, these geometric random variables, to this non-intersecting path is a bijection.
So the geometric choice of the geometric comes from the application?
Well, that comes from the fact that you get, that. Remember in the model I had, the weights were defined that I had weights of a certain, of a product nature, right? I have a product of this. Yeah. No, you couldn't. I mean, to get the kind of measure I had on the non-intersecting paths, these would have to be geometric. If you had something else, you would have interaction between these paths. So that's a very important point, actually, which sort of which specializes this to a certain situation. So that's an important factor. So to connect with what we heard about in the previous talk, no, I'm moving too fast. I should if you can rewrite this growth rule. So if I instead of I sort of change coordinates in this height function, I mean there's sort of a different coordinate system here. I mean you have these integer points here, right? Where you sort of, you see where you have these geometric random variables really sit at these points here. Right? And these are the things that drop down, you see, at even and odd points at different times. So if I look at this, in this coordinate system instead, I have them in sort of the standard rectangular grid like this. So looking upon it this way, which is just this rotation of the coordinates. Then the growth rule goes into this formulation in there. And this has a last passage time percolation interpretation, because if these are these geometric random variables now, just so the omega and the w's are the same, just changing coordinates, then this growth rule means exactly that you take these geometric random variables at this site. And you move along a path like this, and you add the contributions from the sites along this path, and then you take the maximum or all possible paths of this type. You see, I mean, before I come to this point here, I have to have been either at that point or at that point, right? So the best thing I can have here is the best thing I had there or there, this maximum here, and then I add the new randomness that I have at that point. So it translates immediately to this picture here. So the top curve that I had now, if you translate that into this picture, you can see what I do is that I move along these points here. If I look at the GIJs along these points, this is exactly like looking at the top curve. So if I plot the successive values that I read there, these are the heights that I see here. And these up-down steps that I have actually correspond to these steps here. So this construction, I mean, this is not an obvious construction at all. I mean, this is a formulation of the so-called Robinson-Schenstadt-Knuth correspondence in combinatorics. So, I mean, to realize that you should map in exactly this way when you're looking at this polynuclear growth model is not something clear at all. But you can map to these non-intersecting paths in this way and transport the measure and get the type of measure that I discussed on the non-intersecting paths. So all of these problems then can be translated into that picture, right? That's the point. So the second case, as I said, which I discussed when you had first lots of up steps and then lots of down steps, that would mean that I look at the values of Gij at these points instead. Then I would get a different non-intersecting path picture like this. So this problem is you can get random permutations by taking a limit here. If I this geometric random variables have a parameter q, then so this q comes into the non-intersecting path picture by the fact that these vertical sets have a weight square root of q, then. And in the q goes to zero limit, I can get random permutations. They're also connections to total asymmetric simple exclusion process. I don't have the time to describe all of these things, but this is so it's an interesting model in that it connects with different problems like this. So it looks rather arbitrary from the point of view of the non-intersecting path when you first present it like this, but actually there are many different interpretations which makes it an interesting model then. So what about the other case I had? Remember there was this strange picture also. So this actually connects with a very nice tiling problem, which some of you may have seen before. It's called domino tilings of the Aztec diamond. So the Aztec diamond is this kind of shape. You see, I have this kind of shape which gives the boundary of a region here, right? And then I tile it with dominoes, 2x1 rectangles like this. And I look at all possible tiling, say with a uniform probability. And what you see is that you get a certain pitch pattern like this, where things are rather irregular in a circular, approximately circular region here. And then they are very regular, like a brick wall pattern here, close to these points. So these are called the north, east, west, and south poles here, when things are frozen. You see it in a larger example, you see it even clearer. So this region here is sort of the north. I don't know how it's focused enough. There is a certain shape then of this north polar region here where things are frozen. You can see there's a kind of boundary curve here, right? Above this curve, things are frozen, and below they start to become more irregular then. Well, you have four colors because there are actually sort of four types of tiles, which depending on how they, I didn't want to go into this. If you color this Aztec diamond shape in a checkerboard pattern like this, okay, then the dominoes can cover in two different ways. So they can, a vertical, a horizontal domino could be like this or like that. So that gives you two different cases. When you analyze things, it's actually sort of important and interesting to distinguish things. So. And they end up, you can see they end up naturally in these corners. Like that. So how does this relate then to the picture you saw? Well, actually, in this case, there is a mapping also which is not so obvious, but which you can do. The first thing here is sort of well known, that you can describe this tiling by non-intersecting paths. There is a path here which goes through these dominoes in a certain way. So let me briefly indicate this. So if you have a tile like this, you go along it like that. Okay. And if I have a tile of this form, maybe I'm doing it the wrong way now, but you take a step like this. And if I have a tile like this, I go that way. Okay. So I can draw a path on the domain, and if I have this tile, I don't draw any line at all. Okay. If I do it like that, then you will get these paths like this. And of course, since I draw them on separate dominoes like this, they will be non-intersecting, right? They cannot cross. And they will actually uniquely specify the tiling. So there is a natural way of looking upon this as non-intersecting paths, then, if you want to understand this tiling problem. Now, to go from this doesn't fit, so it fits in the general framework in some way. But what I really wanted was this picture where I had several vertical lines where I could put particles and with some fixed initial and final configuration. So when it comes to analyzing things, even though I have some fixed initial sort of and final points here, they don't really fit into the analytical machinery that you want to use here, which I haven't told you about yet. So, but there is a kind of mapping of this picture into this picture that I showed you, which I don't have time to describe. So actually, this is just another representation of this picture here. So there's just a bijection between these. Okay. So the top path that I had corresponds to the top path that I see here, and this has exactly this type of up and down steps that I discussed earlier. So unfortunately, I cannot tell you all the details here, but the top path that you see here actually maps directly to the top path there. So, and this top path here, what you see above this top path is this regular region that you saw, right? So this kind of regular region that you had here, the top path gives you exactly the boundary of that regular region there. Yeah, these are the levels. You will see that clearer in the next. That's exactly true. I mean, there is a height representation also of this model where you see, where you can relate it to that. Yes. So there is actually a connection also with this last passage problem. So let me mention that. If you look at this north polar, at this north polar region, and I put a blue dot on, so this is the part that forms this regular region here. This actually corresponds to this kind of growth problem that I had before, or rather this kind of last passage percolation problem. So if I change coordinate system again and put these points like this, and you have geometric times here, so this corresponds to the case where I have, so think of omega as 1 here, which means that I have a uniform tiling here. So if I look at these points, blue points, what you do, I mean, you can ask, how do I generate these pictures? Well, you generate them by a kind of growth procedure where you go to successively larger tiling. And what you do, what then happens with the North Polar Zone region here, this thing, is that you add things here with a geometric waiting time. Okay? So Q would be a half in the uniform case. So I add independently at these corners here. So I all the time keep this kind of shape, and I successively grow like this. And this means, if you think about it again, so this is a little brief here now, but just to show you the connections, is that how that some of these models are sort of interrelated in some sense. That's what I'm telling you here. So if you look at the shape of all points then, which have been the lower sort of the North Polar region, it's the same as the kind of shape that you have in this last passage percolation problem. I look at, or if you think of this last passage time that we had, and I add something, which means that I start the geometric distribution with 1 instead of with 0. If I look at all points that reach within time n, so this is some kind of shape, right? Which has this form that I showed you here. And you can imagine that as time goes, there should be some kind of limit shape. Like in first passage percolation, we have these limit shape theorems, right? Based on subadditivity. And the same thing is true here. And using this connection, you can actually see that the irregular region here will actually be a circle in the limit. This was proved by Jokisch, Propp, and Shore about 10 years ago. So the limit shape theorem here, which comes from subadditivity, and you can actually also compute what it is in this case. It is a circle here, which is unusual, of course, that you can compute the shape. But But this comes from this connection here. So these two examples are rather rich, and they're all connected in some sense also. Let me now come to my third example, was this, which you could think about that the simplest one, that you have this symmetric random walk. So here are three symmetric random walks, which start at some point 0, 2, 4, and so on, and they end up here at 1, 3, 5, say. So I have some initial points like this. I have some final points which may be shifted. The shift is C minus B here, so you will see the reason in a moment why I call them, write it like this. And then I have B plus C time steps here. So if I draw the whole particle configuration, so if you think at these random walks and I draw the positions here, well, I missed some there. You have a picture like this then. So the measure, let me go back to that we're looking at, is what's the sort of induced measure on this particle configuration here. That's what you really, that's the kind of thing you want to understand. Or you would like to understand, if you think about the previous example, what does the top path behave like? That seems to be particularly interesting in view of the examples we had, right? That was the polynuclear growth model. It was also the boundary to this regular region. So understanding the top path is something particularly interesting, obviously. There is a different interpretation of this, again, as a tiling problem, and here we come to what John said here. If you can, this is, you can actually look at the picture. You see, it's a kind of tiling with rhombi, or you can think of it that you have sort of cubes stacked in a corner, right? You have a rectangular box and you stack cubes in the corner in such a way that you always go down when you go from these two sides, right? And you can describe this by drawing the level line of the cubes like this. And this, if I pick this kind of object uniformly, then it maps directly to these non-intersecting simple symmetric random walks, right? So another interpretation is this picture here. So box planar partition means that you think about it as this kind of height, and you look at the level line like this. And the numbers A, B, and C that we had before are the sides of this rectangular box line. So it's a non-trivial thing which was computed by McMahon about 100 years ago, who introduced this idea of box or planar partitions. It's to compute the number of possible configurations. So that's the famous formula of Major McMahon here. And it's given by this expression here. So what you do to get a probability measure on, you look at, so this is a kind of random height model then, right? You look at all possible surfaces of this type then, picked uniformly of all, among all possibilities. So in a larger picture, it would look something like this then. I mean, you see here is a certain height line. You can see it's a kind of random surface here, right? And one of these paths then is all points having the same height here. And if I look at the sort of particle configuration on a certain vertical line like this, it's related then to the height. I mean, if I count the number of particles up to certain, this will give me exactly the height. And again, you see you have these kind of regular regions typically close to these corners here. And the boundary for the regular region here will be sort of the top, the uppermost height curve there, or the position of the last particle there in this. Okay. You see in this example, it's a natural problem that you want to understand the distribution of these particles. So that leads, in all these examples, this leads to these kind of measures of this general form that I started with. So I said in the beginning that this has some connections with random matrices. So how can we see that? Well, I have this fourth example with the non-intersecting Brownian motions, which I had taken the limit in such a way as we discussed that they all start at the origin and then they separate and they are conditioned to come together again after some time capital T, and they don't intersect. Okay, and I can look at the configuration at certain times like this. So there is some induced particle process on each of these lines. Then. Now I can make a sort of transformation of this. The details are not important. I just make a transformation in time and space in this way with these different times. Then it maps to this kind of picture instead. So I sort of move this to minus infinity and this to plus infinity. I sort of stretch it out in a way with this transformation. And what you get then is a picture like this. And this is actually exactly then the so-called Dyson-Hermitian-Brownian motion. So what's that? Well, this means that you take a Hermitian matrix. Each of the elements of the matrix are independent Einstein-Uhlenbeck processes. Or rather, the real and imaginary parts are that. And you make it Hermitian by reflection. Right? So if I do that, this would be a stationary process, right? I mean, the Einstein-Uhlenbeck process is a stationary process. I project this to the evolution of the eigenvalues. So the matrix evolves, but then the eigenvalues will also evolve. And they will not intersect. Rather, they will evolve in some way like this. So this will be the first, the smallest eigenvalue and so on up to the largest eigenvalue. So if I look, and this Dyson constructed this in such a way that the stationary measure, and this is a stationary process, the induced measure on each line here, if I look at one line here, the stationary measure for this process is the so-called Gaussian unitary ensemble. So this means that you have Gaussian elements in this random matrix. Right? So in this picture here with a non-intersecting path like this, this corresponds actually to a sort of an evolving random matrix whose stationary measure is GUE. Then. So what I would see here is a sequence of GUE measures. Then. And the top curve then corresponds to the evolution of the largest eigenvalue. Then. Now if you think of the general picture I had where if you think of all these discrete models, this is somehow a natural continuous limit of that. All of them, actually, right? I mean, if you did it in some appropriate way. So you would expect that the behavior somehow in suitable scaling limits of these discrete models with all their interpretations that I described should be the same as what you see here. I mean, it's not unreasonable, at least. So that's why you can expect random matrix distributions to come into the in these discrete combinatorial problems that I described to you. So in a sort of a rather vague way now, we can, as I said, I'm not explaining all the technicalities that comes into proving this, but somehow if you think about all these four different examples that I told you about, it's not unreasonable that, of course, in the finite situation they are different, but if I'm asking about scaling limits here, if I zoom in on the top path here and take some suitable limit as the number of lines go to infinity in some way, suitable scaling limits or natural limit processes and limit distributions coming out of these examples should be the same as what you get from random matrix theory. So in order to prove, I mean, we have sort of the combinatorial framework here now. That's what I've described to you now. So to prove this, you have to understand the measure that I've, this induced measure on the particles better than. So in all the examples, what we had was a measure given by a product of determinants. And it turns out then that this kind of measure is, although it looks complicated with all these determinants, it really is a rather nice structure. So this is now the end of the talk a rather technical point, but you do need worry about the details. So from the what I said in the beginning of the talk, the measure is a product of determinants with certain transition functions. Okay. A probability of measure of this form here always has what's called determinantal correlation function. This is, I repeat, it's important that I have fixed initial and final positions of the particles here. So that I have determinantal correlation functions means that if I ask the probability of seeing particles at certain points, so I have these paths here. I mean, I had these paths here. And then I ask, what's the probability? I give you some points here. What's the probability that I see particles at these specified points there? So here I have a particle at this point. Here I don't. So what's the probability that the path will go through some specified points like this, that I see particles at these points? It turns out that if you have a probability measure of this form, then the probability of seeing, or the probability, the density in the continuous case, is given by a determinant like this, involving a certain kernel. So this is rather an algebraic fact, which you can prove using, among other things, this Heine identity. And you can actually give a formula for this correlation kernel. So don't worry about the details now. Let me just tell you that there is a formula for this kernel here, which is rather complicated. It involves sort of the inverse of a large matrix here. Right? Oh, it should be an N there. But in principle, there is some kind of explicit expression for the model, for the correlation kernel here. Right? And if I know the correlation kernel, I can answer any kind of question concerning the probabilities of seeing particles at different points. So all questions, in a sense, then, can be reduced to understanding the behavior of this correlation kernel. So since time is late, I'm rather brief at this point here. But what is clear, if you accept that, so the essential points are, I have this measure given by a product of determinants. This reduces to understanding the behavior of this correlation kernel. So that's the interesting fact about measures of this form. And then I have to understand the scaling limits then of this function here, this kernel. Right? So in order to understand this, I have to compute the asymptotics of this kernel. So in general, the general formula that I showed you briefly here, you cannot do anything with it asymptotically. It's too complicated. But in certain cases, and in particular in the cases that examples that I've told you about, you can actually do something with it. In the cases described to you, the kernel can be expressed in terms of orthogonal polynomials. So in the first example, the so-called Meixner polynomials appear. In the second example, Kravchuk polynomials. In the symmetric random walk. So this was the Aztec diamond, right? This was the polynuclear growth model. This was this non-intersecting random walk. Then you get the so-called Hahn polynomials. All these are so-called discrete orthogonal polynomials. The easiest case is this Brownian motion, or Dyson Brownian motion case, non-intersecting Brownian motion. Then you get Hermite polynomials, which are somehow nicer than the other ones. The kernel looks, these are the Hermite polynomials that come into this kernel in a certain way. You can also, in the first, second, and fourth examples, you can actually write double integral formulas for this kernel also, which are even better in a way if you want to do asymptotics, because you can use saddle point methods. And as I said, the symmetric, this, what you would think is that this non-intersecting symmetric random walks, that's sort of the simplest thing you could think of. Actually, it's more complicated because these Hahn polynomials are much more complicated to understand than, for example, Meixner and Kravchuk. There is no integral formula, simple integral formula for them. Okay, so in the last few minutes now, let me come a little to the limit results, and also to connect with Craig Tracy's talk tomorrow. Then, if you, as I said, the top part was particularly interesting, right? That was the growth process or the boundary of these regular regions. So, if I look at the last particle, so I have this thing here, and I look at the position of the last particle on this line. There are other particles here, right? So look at the distribution of the last particles. It follows from the fact that we have determinantal correlation functions that the distribution of this maximal point on a fixed line is given by a certain Fredholm determinant involving this kernel that we had. And if we have nice expressions for this, we can take a scaling limit in this formula. And in the scaling limit of the, all these kernels, when you scale at the edge, so to say, at the top curve, you get always get the same limiting kernel. So here's the kind of universal limiting behavior comes in, that in the limit, you always get this kernel, the so-called area kernel. So the fluctuations of the last particle, or the top path here, if I look at the single point, will be given by, appropriately scaled down, will be given by this law, which is called the Tracy-Widom distribution. So to prove that, you have to understand the asymptotics of these orthogonal polynomials, which is not too difficult in the Kravchuk case and in the Meixner case. It was only done recently by several people, Miller, McLaughlin, Bike, Kretschebauer, for the Hahn polynomial using Riemann-Hilbert method. It's a very complicated asymptotic actually to do that. So I'm skipping lots of technical things here which are not at all trivial actually. But you can prove in all these cases that I've told you about, you can actually get this kind of limiting behavior. So let me finish now by telling you briefly about the ARI process, which Craig will talk about it also, right, in your talk. So let me just connect now at the very end with that talk. If I look, say you could take any of these examples, or not really, but except this case involving the Hahn polynomial, so the simple symmetric random walks. If I look at this top part, which bounded this regular region here, I mean, you see, this is some kind of natural process here. I mean, it's a graph, right? So you could ask, what's the scaling limit of this random process, which this boundary curve is? So this is sort of the Aztec diamond boundary process. Right? It should be the same as the scaling limit then of the top curve largest eigenvalue evolution of the Hermitian Brownian motion, right? Dyson's Brownian motion. That's what's the intuition. And actually, you can prove that there is a natural limiting process here, and this is what's called the ARI process, which you will hear more about. So if I look at this picture close to the middle here, and I look at the region of the size n to the 2/3, so n is the side length here, the fluctuations of this point would be like n to the 1/3. That's the 1/3 we heard about previously here. Okay, and I look in a certain distance from the center here. So here you see these exponents here. N to the 2/3, that's the right scale in this direction. N to the 1/3 is the size of the fluctuation. So I scale, and this is just the limiting circle, which gives the shape of this regular region. This converges to, in sense of finite dimensional distributions, to a limiting process then, which is this ARI process. It's a stationary process. Since this bends down, it cannot really be a stationary thing. So that's why I have this minus t squared. So this is really what you also get if you scale appropriately in the Dyson-Brownian motion. So I will not define this precisely now. It can be done in terms of the sort of an extended ARI kernel. If you look at a single time, its distribution is this Tracy-Widom distribution. So that's a single time, but you can also look at the behavior several times. So this can also be obtained in the other examples, except still in the case of the planar partitions. In this case, I mean, there are expressions then for the joint distribution of this at different times in terms of the Hahn polynomials, but there's a technical thing remaining to really work out the asymptotics in that case. Okay, this was a lot of material. What I wanted to say here, to sum up very briefly, is that actually these are the only case where you can prove these kind of results, more or less. I mean, there are some variations still, but I think that they could probably also be fit into this framework then. So, and what you would like to do, I mean, is to generalize this to more general other situations. Other lost passage percolation problems, other timing problems. There are many possible variations here. But the fact that it all works in this case is because it maps to this kind of process with non-intersecting paths that I've described initially. So there's a common structure in all the sort of exactly solvable cases here. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.